Welcome back to WordBalloon.com, the comic book conversation show. This is John Sundress. Today, we speak with writer-producer Andrew Cosby, the co-creator of Eureka, the new hit weekly series on the Sci-Fi Channel. In Eureka, U.S. Marshal Jack Carter finds himself in a secret community set up decades ago where the world's greatest scientists have taken residence to develop the great inventions we all take for granted. The trouble is, with all the advancements created, all the experiments that went wrong are there too. The comedy adventure series debuted this summer to high ratings and numerous downloads at iTunes. Cosby's co-creator, Jamie Paglia and company, have taken full advantage of today's marketing tools with podcast commentaries and even webisodes of a separate story at sci-fi.com. Andrew's no stranger to comic books. He and Jason Alexander had success at Dark Horse with the vampire miniseries Damnation. He's also a writer at Ross Ritchie's Boom Studios comic company, where he and fellow Eureka writers have written such books as Exile, The Savage Brothers, and The Enigma Cipher. Our conversation begins with Andrew's take on the difference of writing screenplays and comic books.
My first comic book was Damnation, which I did for Dark Horse. And I got to say, and I know a lot of screenwriters that would agree with me, some of the hardest writing I've ever done has been writing for comic books. It's difficult, man. I love it. I mean, it's really rewarding. And, you know, as cool as it is to see your TV show on, you know, on television on a weekly basis, like, it's just as cool to walk into a comic shop and see that book on the rack, you know, and even cooler to not see the book on the rack because it's been sold. it's a good feeling. And I think what it is for me, especially with comics, is I don't know, there's something from my childhood that's, you know, going to the 7-Elevens and spinning that little spinner rack and seeing the books hanging out. It just taps into something that's kind of core to my being, I guess. And you get to do stuff in comics you don't get to do on television and film.
No budget constraints, I'm sure.
Exactly, none at all. And you get to, other than page count, which is part of the difficulty of writing the damn things, is, you know, you've really got to be economical. And, you know, I think you have to, you know, you get trained to do that, you know, writing in television and writing film anyway, is that it's all about economy of language.
Mm-hmm.
And which is okay by me, because I'm the failed novelist who, I don't ever want to have to consider writing 400 pages of anything ever again in my life. There's just something really, when you have a set of rules, you know, it's like writing sonnets. Somehow it makes it easier when the rules are there. And definitely comics has that sort of haiku quality to it. It's like, here are your pages. You can't go too many panels per page. You can't do too few. You get into that storytelling rhythm. You're telling stories very visually, even though there's, you know, a lot of room for dialogue and stuff like that. I still like that, you know, unlike any other medium, a lot of the storytelling is between the panels.
Mm-hmm.
About what you're not showing and letting the reader's mind kind of fill in the gaps. I love that about comics, and I actually love that about great filmmaking. I think if you look at some of the best filmmakers, they leave a lot up to the audience, and it makes the experience interactive, and I love that. I mean, and you know, my pop culture geekness doesn't stop there. Video games, toys, I love it all. My poor wife.
Now, how did you hook up with Boom? I know Ross was involved with Damnation.
Yeah, well, Ross and I go way back. We started, I think, working at Malibu Comics, I think it's back in 1991, about a week apart.
Okay.
Never met each other before, although we're both Southern boys, although I argue with him that Texas isn't really the South. I think once he visited the actual South, he realized how glad he was of that fact. We both got jobs in the Malibu marketing department, and we just hit it off right away. Ross immediately knew I was full of shit, and I love that in a person when they can see right through me like that. But we talked comics. We liked all the same movies. Both big film geeks. Like he had gone to film school. Actually had a pretty good pedigree film school wise. I had just sort of always wanted to work in movies, but never put in any sort of sweat equity to get to that place. And he was the guy who told me, you know, you ought to think about screenwriting. He was working on a script with a friend of his, and he asked me for some help just on the story stuff, and I kind of came in and said, you know, I really like the central concept, but I would change all this and change that, and I really pissed his partner off, and we ended up finishing the script together. That's how I got my first agent, was writing the script with him. But he's the guy that talked me into being a screenwriter. first I was, you know, I didn't cotton to the idea at all. I was like, you know, I took him down to this, we were at this, I forget where it was, but there was a newsstand. And I said, Ross, let me show you something. And I showed him on the newsstand all these screenwriting magazines. Mm-hmm. It was like, you know, screenplay, script, screenwriter, whatever. They had all these magazines, and I was like doing the math for him, saying, you know, it takes this much, this many people to keep a subscription going. There's this many magazines come out a year. So there's you know, XYZ amount of people who are wanting to get into the business. Now, that doesn't include the people who are already in the business who are looking for work and can't get work. That doesn't even include the people who are in the business who are successful and are getting work. I mean, there's just so many people in this industry. And he just sat there and shook his head and goes, Cosby, 120 pages, double-spaced. And I was sold. You know, again, failed novelist, 120 pages, double-spaced, a lot of his dialogue, I'll take it. And, you know, never looked back. Have been very fortunate in that respect.
You said, and I've heard other film and television writers that have tried to write comics, specifically Alan Hynberg. When I talked to him, he said he really had to get used to writing a lot of direction and certainly the scene, because a lot of that is left up, obviously, to the director. And
yeah, well, I'm a wannabe director, so I embrace that part of it. And it's certainly, like, part of the reason I got into writing was that's my ultimate goal. I think it's why I ended up working in television, is I like the control. I like being able to shape a creative vision in that way.
Sure.
That's one of the things I really love about comics, but it's tough. I mean, it's really to think visually. And remember, you also have to think better visually than anyone else that's going to do the work. Like, because in some ways, you're kind of telling the artist, this is what I see. And there's two ways of writing comics. I mean, some of the stuff I write, I think they call it Marvel style, where you're doing more of like page descriptions, and mm-hmm. the artist is breaking them down into panels however you want. The first book I wrote, I broke the panels down myself. I really wanted to prove to myself that I could be an official comic book writer, and I worked with a great artist, just an amazing guy, Jay Alexander, does this great painted work. I could not have gotten more fortunate on my first comic book experience.
Is that Jason Alexander as well, the guy who's doing a lot of money work?
I used to call him Jay.
You guys are tight. That's okay.
Yeah, well, we're just also trying to avoid the Seinfeld. I think once Jason Alexander got famous, he's a great guy, a brilliant artist.
Beautiful artist, absolutely.
It's great, too, because we, for the cover of the first Damnation book, we got a lot of heat from everybody. Like, no one liked the cover that we designed. And we worked on it together. We, like, you know, we'd be on the phone, we'd be talking about the position of the hands and the stance and what it should look like. And we, you know, Jason would do these sketches. And you know, we didn't get a great reception. I didn't get a good reception from Ross. I kind of showed it to him. And Scott Alley was kind of like, yeah, I don't know. And it was a weird cover, but we just thought this is going to be really cool. And even when it was painted everything, we still had our skeptics, and it turned out to win like Cover of the Month in Wizard, and Jason got some award from the Illustrators Guild or whatever that is, like, for it. It's been in showings and stuff now.
Oh, wow.
Really, really happy with that. But it just goes to show you, like, you know, one of the things that I love about comics is the sort of freedom that you get. Like, you know, you can have guys throwing notes at you, and certainly, you know, a lot of the notes are really good. But it's not a really notes-driven industry in the way that TV and film are.
Sure.
There's a lot of creative freedom in writing comics, and I'm imagining and drawing them as well, that just makes me keep wanting to come back to it. And the kinds of stories you get to tell are just like, I just finished this book. I shouldn't say finished it. I finished the first few issues. Called Savage Brother.
Yes.
That I'm doing with Boom, and it's a crazy concept.
Tell people about the concept who haven't read it yet.
It's basically like, I was sitting around going, you know, there's all these movies and these books and TV shows are all about, you know, ooh, how do we stop the apocalypse? How do we cut the blue wire before the apocalypse bomb explodes or whatever? And I thought, you know, well, what a great setting it would be if it was, where it's like too late. You know, you start the story off with the apocalypse has happened, deal with it, and one step further, take these two characters who've actually come into their own at the end of the world. Like, they were nothing before. They were like a couple of brothers who ran a salvage yard, but lo and behold, here comes the end of days, and, you know, all the good people went away, and there's these people that are left behind, and there's, you know, it's lakes of fire and raining blood, plagues of locusts, and they've actually found a little niche for themselves, and they like it.
I smell a business.
Yeah, exactly. I smell business opportunity here. And actually their business is, you know, it starts with, they'll do basically anything for money. They're kind of, you know, they're these two sort of good old boys who basically, one's kind of a fast-talking con artist, and his brother's more of just that, like, you know, muscle-bound brute. And they just, they do whatever it takes to make a go of it, and trading their services for beer and canned food and fresh water and things like that. And it's just a, it's a fun book. It's a fun book about two con artists who stumble into an adventure story and kind of become reluctant heroes.
Sure.
As they, you know, run into the last virgin on Earth. And again, like, what other industry is someone going to hear that and go, I love it.
Yeah,
we do it. Although we've actually gotten a really good, we've gotten some attention outside of comics because of the sort of supernatural Men in Black of it. It's got kind of like, the tone is very comedic and it doesn't take itself too seriously, and it's got this sort of great action-adventure spine. Listen to me brag about my own book. It's easy for me to brag because I actually am writing it with Johanna Stokes, who is also one of the writers. I hired her on my television series Eureka, and she just proved to be one of these great go-getters, really talented writer. And we're having a blast. She was the perfect voice for the project. And now we're getting, because of the sort of comedic voice of the thing, we're getting a lot of attention from Hollywood.
That's cool.
Which is always nice. I mean, better than people, you know, kicking you in the eye.
Well, and I was wondering about the fact that Johanna and also John Rogers, you guys all work together at Boom. You guys all work together at Eureka as well.
Yeah, well, we're one big happy family. We're dysfunctional as hell, but we're happy. John's one of these guys that, like, Ross and I met him years ago. He's just one of these huge screenwriters, hugely successful. We've actually seen his, or at least a good portion of his path to fame and fortune, and hasn't changed one iota. The guy's just brilliant. You know, figuratively and literally, he's also one of the most intelligent human beings I've ever met. We just love doing stuff together. I mean, John and I have written scripts together, or I should say a script together. We were talking about working on another one. It's a collaborative group, what can I say? No one's afraid of collaboration. We like working together, so oftentimes when one of us has an idea for a movie or a TV show or a comic book, we'll go to the other, whoever we think we'll have the most fun with working on it, or who we think would bring something unique to the table, and we end up working together. It's actually, to tell you how incestuous the story is, Johanna's, you know, journey into, you know, screenwriting and television writing started with John. Like, John was one of the first people to recognize the writer and Joe, who was this, there's this girl we knew that was kind of struggling to find herself, and John had created this pilot for USA Network called Red Skies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Joe, he told all of his friends, you know, if you're interested, write a spec. You know, it's a good show to spec on. And he had actually gotten a deal from the studio. I think it was USA Network, I think. And I think they had ordered a certain number of scripts, like just to test balloon. And so knowing this, Johanna went and wrote a spec of Red Skies. And for those of you who don't know what that is, that's like when you're writing for free and you know it. Because you write for free a lot in this industry, you just don't know it yet. You don't realize that the producers are going to get 19 drafts out of you. But so Joe goes and writes this spec script just to kind of show John what she's capable of. And I think at the end of the day, among all of the scripts that they had bought, including John's, Johanna's script was the only one that USA approved.
Wow.
Yeah.
So was that the pilot?
No. He had already shot the pilot.
Oh, okay.
You know, and by the way, first time she'd ever put pen to paper to tell a story.
Wow.
Right. Never written anything like that in her life. And so told this story when I was, you know, setting up to do Eureka, and decided to give her a shot on the show. She came in and pitched, had to pitch along with everyone else, and just had this great story concept. And it was like more or less we bought in the room, and so we want her to write this story. It's great. So we put on a 10-week gig. Long story short, we had problems getting the story across the plate with the network and getting the right outline broken. It was just, you know, it's that first year television madness. And when her 10 weeks was up, when her 10 weeks were up, we had to cut her loose. And it was tough. It was a tough call. And but she doesn't take no for an answer. So what does she do? She goes off and she writes. She figures, listen, I don't write treatments. So, of course, my treatment never got across the plate because that's not what I do well.
Okay.
But I know I believe in the story. So what she does is she goes and she writes it on spec. A few weeks later, she sends it to me and Jamie. And we read it. Brilliant. Brilliant. Like one of the best first drafts we got. A few weeks later, we're shooting the damn thing. End of story, by the end of the first season, she's got 3 produced screenplay credits and a 4th credit, story credit on the season finale of the series.
Oh, that's really cool. Always interested in the behind-the-scenes facts like that on shows like Eureka, and I do want to talk a lot about Eureka as well in general, but I want to give you credit for a couple other Boom books, one that's currently being written, and that's Exile, or currently coming out, and one that's coming up in the future that I'm really interested in, and that's The Enigma Cipher.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so let's talk about Exile at first. The concept on its surface looks like it might be something like Lost, but it to me, struck a chord with Mysterious Island, the old, was that Jules Verne? Yeah, the old Jules Verne story.
Yeah, no, Lost World in Mysterious Island.
Oh, sure, yeah, Arthur Conan Doyle, absolutely.
Yeah, it's like, that is definitely what I was going for. Really.
Okay.
How to do kind of the, almost the Michael Crichton-ish take on Mysterious Island and Lost World.
Okay.
Things of that nature. Almost didn't do the project because of Lost. Like, I was kind of like, well, boy, there's this really big mystery island in everyone's face right now, and should I do this story? But, you know, it was, again, it was comics, and I just thought, you know, it's a great opportunity to go tell a story I want to tell. And I'm kind of not a new father, but my kid's like 2.5.
Okay.
Actually almost 3 now. And for me, it was like I wanted to tell a story of a father and daughter story, and I was looking for opportunities to do that. And that's really what, for me, Exile was about. And I actually think, like, I think the first couple of issues are out now, and it very much seems like a Monster Island story. It actually is it's a sci-fi story, and you'll see as the series continues that there's some cool reveals to it, actually what this island is and where the weird flora and fauna and indigenous creatures are coming from. And I think if people can push through, I mean, you know, I've gotten a good reception to the book, which is great.
Cool.
But I think even for those naysayers who just think it's another Monster Island concept, they're mistaken, and they'll know soon enough.
Very cool.
Had a lot of fun on that one, and wrote that with a buddy of mine, Mike Nelson, who's also a very talented writer, writing on some film books. Second Wave being, I think, one of the best ones that he's written. It's a really great book.
That's the War of the Worlds book that he's doing with Chi.
Yeah.
I had Russ on a couple of weeks ago, and I'm a big Boom fan. I like the fact that they're interesting concepts, they're interesting genres, things that aren't being addressed by a lot of other publishers, and I think that just makes for good stories and more variety.
You know, your lips to God's ears. I think they're doing the same thing. I really like the company. I really like, you know, Ross has a great eye for artists and a great eye for story, and we just try to choose things that we think are cool. I mean, it's really that simple. We're not trying to just do things we think would make good movies or whatever. Although I think there's always kind of a part of our brain that's like, even comics for us are movies on paper.
Okay.
And we like the big, you know, we like the big popcorn stuff. I think we're very much Spielberg Lucas kids. So I think that translates into everything we do in our lives. And we've had a lot of, you know, a lot of good fortune that we have had the real movie industry come out and take notice of some of our properties. But, yeah, like you said, I think we're just trying to do something that, not so much that we were looking and seeing a hole in the industry, because I don't think there's necessarily a hole in comics, but I think for us it was at least something we could, we felt we had a good eye for story and properties and concepts, and we just wanted to, like, take that into the comic book world and see what we could do with it. And certainly, all the credit goes to Ross. Ross started Boom on his own, and it was sort of a brainchild of his and a baby of his, and I got to come in later. I was fortunate enough to get to partner up with him a little bit into the process, and hopefully I'm bringing something to the table. At least he says I am, so as long as he's fooled.
Do you have more concepts that you're planning just for comic books beyond, like, the I know the Enigma Cipher is coming up. I know you have a story in the Ninja Tales anthology that's coming up as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to keep pumping out comics as long as they'll let me.
Cool.
Enigma Cipher certainly next on the plate. Just finished the first issue of that and working on issue two as we speak. There's some other stuff in the hopper. Mr. Stuffins is a book that I've had in my back pocket for a long time, and it's kind of like one of those Savage Brothers where you're just really glad there's some industry that will let you tell this story of a little boy who basically finds out his teddy bear is a secret agent. That's not really what the story is, but it's as close as I can pitch it in one sentence.
Okay.
But it's a fun sort of wish fulfillment kind of story of when I was a kid, I had a teddy bear, and I imagined that, like, he was doing all sorts of stuff when I wasn't around. And so I created this concept that is essentially a scientist who's developed this chip that was created for, downloaded with, like, elite soldier combat information, so that, you know, in the future, you won't need to train soldiers as much as you'll need to just give them, you know, implant this chip, and they'll have built-in information, kind of like in The Matrix, I Know Kung Fu, right?
Sure, sure.
And he finds out he's, you know, working for the bad guys, goes on the run, hides the chip inside this sort of interactive Teddy Ruxpin-type teddy bear, and the kid, you know, the kid's father buys the bear, and when the bear gets turned on, he rips himself out of the package, he turns the box around, sees the 800 number on it, and dials, and says, this is Agent 485, I'm active. And is convinced he's some sort of super soldier, and of course, you know, it being a recording, one of the aspects of the recording is, you know, that kid safety comes first. And so the bear takes that as his mission statement, that he's somehow supposed to protect this boy. Meanwhile, the bad guys are after the chip that they eventually find out is inside the bear. Just a crazy, crazy fun idea that you get to, you know, run loose with in comics.
That's fantastic. How long are the arcs? Because it seems like Boom is being very careful about, you know, telling, you know, short story arcs that they can, you know, then obviously put together, make a trade, and, you know, if it doesn't do well on the shelves as a monthly, try and sell it to the bookstores.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's part of the, I stay a little bit away from the business plan side
okay.
of things. I know that for me, you know, the discussions I've had with Ross were that miniseries are great because, you know, I think Hellboy is a great example of how you just do these stories, and if they're successful, you do more and more and more.
You bet.
And more. And it seems like a great business model because I think, like any good, I don't want to, you know, A, I don't think we have the resources to shove anything down anyone's throat, but B, you don't want to shove anything down the consumer's throat. If they like it, they buy it, great, you can make more of it. If they don't like it, there's more stories out there. I mean, even within the company, I mean, itself, we've got so many stories we'd love to tell that part of it is just deciding on, first off, what creatively inspires us. And then it's, you know, let the public decide. You know, put the books on the shelves and see what people like. And you know, if they like some, we get. I mean, even if the sales aren't great, if they like them, you know, we try to get behind the book and make sure it gets out there and stays on the shelves and just do our jobs.
And I wanted to ask about Enigma Cipher because I'm a World War II fan of the history, and I didn't see U-571, but I did see the British film Enigma, and of course I've seen enough A&E and History Channel to know about the device as well.
Well, I'm the other way around. I've seen U-571, but I haven't seen Enigma. Basically, the Enigma was this, like, multi-rotor, typewriter-type encoding device that was used by the Nazis in the Second World War. It was, at the time, the most sophisticated encryption device that had been designed, and we couldn't break it. We could not break the Enigma codes. The movie U-571 was actually about how this heroic effort was made to get our hands on one of the Enigma machines, which were these typewriter-type devices, like I said, that could decode the codes, and hopefully we could, you know, our code breakers could break them once we had our hands on one of the machines. And in fact, that was a successful mission, and we got our hands on one of the Enigma machines. And what was so imperative about the mission is we had to get this machine off of a sub, but we could never let the Nazis know we had the machine, and they'd just go change everything.
Certainly.
And it would be pointless. And it's once we had that, device in World War II, the Allies were actually able to decrypt a number of important, pieces of intel that then allowed us to save a lot of lives and win a lot of, victories in the war. It might have even been pivotal to winning the war. So, long story short, what gave me the idea for this was I had heard about recently they had done this, there were like three Enigma ciphers that were left from World War II that had yet to be decrypted. And through distributed computing, which is, linking one computer to another and running this kind of shareware decryption program, I think it was Alan Turing's team, I don't know all the details offhand, but they were able to basically break some or all of these leftover codes. And I just found that fascinating. What really sparked me in that was, wow, there are codes left over from World War II that people haven't broken.
Right.
And I thought, I wonder what's in those. And then it dawned on me, it's like, what if there's a piece of information in those that's like somehow prevalent today, and pertinent today, rather? And what would that be? And what would people do to keep that from coming to light?
Sure.
And so that was how I came up with this idea for Enigma Cipher, which is a story of a college professor who gets his. It's really a story of a college student. Whose professor gets his hands on one of these unbroken codes, and she decides to take it upon herself as part of a distributed computing project that she's doing to break the code. And before she can do that, people start showing up dead. And so obviously there's something inside that code that someone somewhere very powerful does not want decrypted. So it's sort of like a I hate to use this meets that, but it's sort of like a Da Vinci Code by way of the Bourne identity.
Sure.
Kind of project.
I know the history of the Enigma Code, and it's easy to say, oh, it's a Da Vinci kind of thing, and it's like, well, no, Enigma had its own story as well, and it's great that you're tapping into that, because I think that is a really interesting piece of real history that does lend itself for interesting fiction.
Yeah, there's great history there, and there's it mixed that with another piece of history, which is that that a lot of Nazi spies made it to American soil and were kind of planted here as sleeper agents. There's just a lot of
sure.
historical fact that I was able to sort of put into the blender and create my own kind of fictional story, which feels anchored in that real, grounded history. And, Nazis are great bad guys.
You bet.
anything that can, any movie where you can punch a Nazi is good for me. And even though it might not be as literal as that in Enigma Cipher, I think the spirit of punching Nazis is there.
Well, and I also think it's an interesting mystery, and I like crime comics and I like mystery adventure comics because I think it evokes a time when there weren't that many more genres in comics and were very successful and even good stories coming out of them, but that, yeah, you can tell this kind of story in a comic book and it can be interesting.
Weirdly enough, one of my inspirations for doing Enigma, choosing that to do as a book was another Boom book called Talent, mm-hmm. which I think had a very sort of cool, Tom and Chris did a great job of creating this sort of political intrigue in that first issue. Like, when I read the first issue of Talent, I went, wow, like, I forgot comics could do this kind of thing, where it just felt very kind of political, like a thriller, like reading a thriller
you bet.
In comic book form. And I fell in love with, trying to sort of emulate some of that. And of all the sort of back pocket ideas I had, Enigma seemed the right fit. Hopefully people will like it. Hopefully they'll. I don't pretend to be able to do as good a job as Chris and Tom did on Talent, but I'm going to give it my best.
Very cool. And I do want to talk about Eureka because I saw the pilot as I was packing, leaving the San Diego Con. I caught the Sunday afternoon replay of it on the Sci-Fi Channel, and really enjoyed it. And have seen a couple episodes since. Unfortunately, my local system. They bumped up Sci-Fi Channel to the digital channel, so I've gone on iTunes and I've been buying the episodes. And
we've been doing really well on iTunes. It's blown my mind. Like, someone sent me an email the other day that was like, we were like four out of the top 10 downloaded television shows. that four of them were Eureka episodes. And it blew my mind. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. There's that many people downloading these iTunes, and where's my share of that?
Exactly. How is the show performing on the Sci-Fi Network?
Yeah, really well. We've been
great.
We've been really lucky. You know, obviously, a lot of hard work went into it. We got a great cast and a great crew and a great group of writers. Everything kind of came together. The network's been very supportive, as has the studio. But we launched, the series launched at a 3.2.
Which is amazing for cable.
The highest rated series launch that the network had had in its 14-year history.
Wow.
Did not expect it. And Tuesday night, I mean,
yeah.
we were freaking out. We're like, you know, Tuesday night we did not think was a destination night.
In the middle of the summer, too.
Yeah. And, you know, here we go, and we have this huge launch. You know, everyone's very obviously pleasantly surprised. And then the ratings for the show, we consistently, there's been a couple of times where something else came in, but consistently we've been the highest rated series they've had in their 14-year history.
That's fantastic.
And we continue to be the highest rated show they have on their network. There were a couple of weeks where I think wrestling beat us by fractions, but we've since kicked wrestling's ass.
That's cool.
No, I mean, it's you know, you couldn't ask for more. Part of us choosing to go to the Sci-Fi Network with the concept originally was we really felt like this was this sort of burgeoning network. This was before Battlestar Galactica had come on the scene.
Okay.
So we felt like here's this burgeoning network that had a shift in management. And I had bumped into Mark Stern during the upfront in New York for my last series, very short-lived series called Haunted.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to Jamie, who I wrote the pilot with and created the show with, and we were just talking about, like, you know, we have other opportunities, but at Sci-Fi Channel, there's a chance for us to really make a splash. And we kind of, you know, took estimation at the time, took a risk. We're like, we're going to take a risk. We're going to go to we're going to do the show. We're going to do it for cable. We're going to hope they give us the budget that we want. We're going to hope for a lot of support, and we got everything we wanted. Great support. Got to cast who we wanted to cast, and luckily it all came together. And so far, so good. I mean, certainly there's things that need improving, like any first run, you know, first season show.
Sure.
You look back, and there's a lot of hindsight's 2020, and there's things that we're going to take into second season, you know, knock wood, and make better. But, you know, it's you can't ask for more than coming on the scene and being their number one rated series. Not only their number one rated series now, but the number one rated series in the history of their network. That's we're very, very proud of that and very happy. And also very happy to be, you know, part of the family with a sister show like Battlestar Galactica, which I just think is amazing television.
No, I agree with you.
Ron Moore and David Icke have done just wonderful things with that series. The guy who directed their first miniseries, Michael Reimer, is actually the guy who directed my last pilot, Haunted.
Oh, wow.
Just an amazing director.
You bet he is.
And in fact, on Haunted, he was doing reshoots for us when he came to the set one day. And he pulled me aside and said, Andrew, let me talk to you for a second. You're a bit of a geek, right? And of course, I'm, you know, happy to admit it. Yeah. And he said, tell me what you think about Battlestar Galactica. And, you know, he's from Australia. And
okay.
By the way, worst Australian accent fake ever. That's as close as I get. But, you know, well, certainly he was familiar with the show, but not, I think there wasn't a fandom for it necessarily for him growing up the way it was for for guys like me who, you know, would have given our eye teeth for a Cylon.
You bet.
And I just, you know, I still remember that because, like, I thought, you know, the minute he told me what Ron was planning to do with the series, I got angry because I had wanted to do that with Star Trek for like a decade.
Wow.
Like the exact same idea. I was like, oh, if only Star Trek would do this. I knew that every Star Trek fan in the world would hate me because it's so not Star Trek. So it's, Ron was obviously 8 steps ahead of me in doing the smarter thing by doing it with Galactica. And it's just, I've continually been a great series for them. But you know what? I'm going to stop bragging about Ron Moore on my podcast.
Well, I will marry Galactica to Eureka and pointing out, and this is what I've learned from your podcast of commentaries, that you guys share the same special effects company?
Yeah, Zoic. Yeah. Great guys, really talented company, and always go the extra mile. I cannot say enough great things about this company. Just they do exceptional work. The work they've done on Battlestar has been stupendous, and the work they've done for us has been above and beyond. It's just great.
And for people who haven't seen Eureka, you really do have to see it, because I think you made the right decision going to a place like the Sci-Fi Channel, because this is the kind of cool show that could get lost in the cracks, like some of the other shows that the networks took a gamble on this season based on the success of shows like Lost, and even maybe the missed opportunity that NBC had, that I guess they could have had Galactica run as well on the NBC network. But clearly, you know, I think from a critical standpoint, Galactica has certainly gotten a lot of, like, you know, steam of, I can't believe this show, that more people don't know about this show. And honestly, I'll say the same thing about Eureka. It's a lighter show. It's a funnier show, obviously, but it really works, and it's a good mainstream show that can build an audience. And I think being in a place like Sci-Fi Channel might give you that opportunity.
I hope so. I think so, too. And I think if you look at our numbers, you know, we were worried as, like, you know, people went back to school and the network shows started popping back up on Tuesday nights. We're really worried we'd take a big hit in our numbers, and we actually, last night, I think, had one of our biggest numbers yet. So I think we found an audience, which is great. And I definitely am, you know, would never regret the decision of going with Sci-Fi for all those factors, but also for just how supportive they've been of us creatively. You know, not that we haven't had our battles, because we have. I think you always do. But just, you know, it's a weird show. Let's be honest. We're blending humor, you know, a blend of comedy and action and a little bit of suspense and sometimes horror and science fiction in a Mayberry-esque town, you know. Like, it's a weird show. And these guys took a chance with us, you know, and we told them when we pitched it. We're like, you know, we're going to be a strange show. We're going to go for this weird hybrid of Twin Peaks and Northern Exposure, and, you know, it's hopefully it'll be a taste that people like. And, you know, we thought we were making chocolate peanut butter, but we could have been making chocolate and avocado. We just didn't know.
Sure.
We trusted our gut, and we went with it. And the great thing is Sci-Fi trusted our gut. And in a lot of ways, like, you know, there were a lot of elements, you know, casting and otherwise, where they didn't necessarily agree with our choices, but they supported us anyway. You know, we had to fight a lot of those battles, but they supported us, and it all seems to be working out.
You got really cool people. I mean, Colin Ferguson is fantastic as the Marshal, and
great
to see Joe Morton and guys like Matt Frewer. I mean, that's the thing. I think you have Touchstone guys that Sci-Fi fans, if they saw him, would realize, oh, wow, I didn't realize they're involved. Plus, Deborah Ferrantino, always nice to look at.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Sally Richardson, very nice to look at.
You can definitely see the geek in me when you look at the casting of the series, because it's like I grabbed onto every sci-fi icon that was available that I could get. You know, obviously, Joe Morton was a coup for us, and Matt Frewer is great. I'd like to take a moment here to just brag about my cast. Not only are they all great actors, and that the chemistry works, but they're just great people. I mean, it's such a great family to work with. You know, Colin, I call Colin my quarterback because he's so great. His energy level is always high. He's always willing to go the extra mile for the show. I think he's been like, he's probably worked harder marketing this show than anybody. And, you know, our marketing department's been fantastic. So it's just a really, you know, Ed Quinn, who plays Nathan Stark. Just a great group of people. Sally Richardson Woodfield, who plays Allison. They're just fun to be around, and they keep the crew happy, and vice versa. And it's a rare, unique experience to work with these people.
Well, and I think Colin specifically too. If for people who haven't seen it, he's almost like the way Ben Browder was on Farscape, where he's just this average guy surrounded by all this craziness, and he is just kind of got the gut level, or even Richard Dean Anderson in Stargate,
yeah,
where he's just the meat and potatoes guy that is surrounded by this brain trust of this community and all these crazy things, and he's just kind of there with the reflexive, real base answers of, well, can we turn it off?
Yeah, very much the ordinary guy in extraordinary circumstances.
Can you kick it? You know, I mean, it's,
yeah,
and that's great.
So, exactly. He's like, I'd piss on a spark plug if I thought it helped. He's so that guy. I think that's it's a great quality that he has. He just plays a great, well, first off, he's sort of a comedic genius, and he plays a great straight man.
Yep.
And even when he's being his own straight man, he's just great at it. He's got phenomenal timing. I think a lot of our actors have great comedic timing. Comedy's tough to do, and you know, I think we only have sort of dipped our toes in the water this scene. I hope to sort of flex a little more comedic muscle second season, but it's tough. It's, and like I said before, it's a really, any genre hybrid's tough. You know, luckily we had some great blueprints to kind of follow from guys like Joss Whedon.
Sure.
The brilliance of Buffy and Angel, I think everyone's familiar with. To me, it's like that imprint. It was easy to imprint on something like Angel and Buffy and go, all right, see, it's possible. It's possible to have a show that, you know, goes to an emotional place, goes to a comedic place, goes to sort of the action-adventure place. I don't pretend that we're anywhere near that level of show, but certainly that's our light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, and I'm also impressed with the choice to have more standalone episodes this season, and there's an overarching story, but I think it's an accessible overarching story, at least from the handful of episodes that I've seen so far. And again, I think that, you know, it's an approachable show that you can kind of jump in on now, and I will continue to watch it on iTunes.
That's great. You know, so, I appreciate that. I mean, that was a conscious decision, because we could have very easily gone a little more of the X-Files route.
Sure.
We did kind of use X-Files as a template in that I think they did a really great job with standalones early on. But they were always really mythology heavy. I don't think we're as mythology heavy, although there are some really interesting aspects to our mythology. And I think once people get into the show, they're going to get hungry for that. We definitely want to have enough mythology for the loyal viewers to where they feel like they're being taken someplace. But I really like the standalone type shows. I really like, you know, it's kind of like old classic Star Trek. It's like,
yes,
you get to go and just turn on an episode, and you get a great beginning, middle, and end. And you didn't need to see the episode before it or necessarily the one after it. I really wanted that. I think that's part of sort of the genre to a degree. And I wanted to bring that to the series. Because I think a lot of series right now are doing an exceptional job of being serialized. I mean, mm-hmm. Lost and 24. There are these great serials on TV right now, and I didn't necessarily want to compete with them and didn't feel like I needed to. I think it's kind of like they've got that corner of the universe right now. Well, let's go be the other show.
And also, if you do dip too far into a mythology, some people might feel like if they hadn't seen, you know, episode one, that it might be kind of impenetrable, and they might not be able to jump in.
Oh, certainly, yeah. You certainly want people to be able to kind of, with a new series, jump in the water whenever they feel like it, or if they hear from someone else that it's a cool show, they can go check it out and not feel completely lost. I think, you know, we purposely designed the series to kind of play that way first season, and we'll continue to a certain degree. One of the fun things about the show is getting to kind of do a sci-fi homage of the week, find some new cool sci-fi idea that we can do, or find some classic sci-fi concept that we can turn on its head.
Mm-hmm.
That's the fun of the show, and I swore when we started this thing that we were going to have a very concrete beginning, middle, and end, very satisfying, complete episodes with each episode. We may get more serialized with the character development in second season, but I don't think the show itself will ever get outside of that that encapsulated plot line.
Okay.
Because I think it works.
Tell me about the webisode story, because was that ever going to be an episode, and you guys decide? I mean, how did the, you know, I understand that a lot of shows are using that kind of marketing to cross-promote, and I think it's a great idea. I also think it's fun when shows like your own, you know, kind of have a separate story going on in the webisodes. So, yeah, like, what was the decision of that story? Like, was it created specifically for the webisodes?
Well, the story concept, oddly enough, was the original pilot concept, but in a very different form. We had this original concept for the pilot that dealt with, you know, there being some sort of creature loose in this weird town that turns out to be a government think tank. And the decision was finally made that we didn't really want to start with a monster episode for the pilot, because we thought people might think we're a Monster of the Week show.
Sure.
And we definitely did not want to send that message. But we always loved the concept. And we floated the idea around for a while as a as an episode idea, and everyone liked it. We had all these other concepts that we were breaking, and other things, you know, either came easier or we thought were more challenging, just depending. And then when the idea of doing webisodes came up, I just thought, well, A, I still love this story. Jamie still loves the story. There are aspects of the pilot we always missed that weren't in the show. But also, for us, I wanted to do something, and I'm not sure it worked at the end of the day, but I wanted to do something for the web where the first episode, you wouldn't necessarily know it was part of a webisode.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm one of these guys that's like, if I'm looking on the web and someone sends me Bigfoot footage, I'm going to look at it. Like, every time. I've got the biggest man crush on Bigfoot that you can imagine. Like, I swear, if I went traveling in the Pacific Northwest and was, like, camping, which you'll probably never see me do, but if I went camping for some odd reason and ran into Bigfoot, it would change my life. I would give up everything. I would probably never leave those woods. I would bring out cameras, and I'd be like a Bigfoot hunter. I feel like that about really any supernatural experience. Like, if I saw a UFO, if I could concretely, if I knew, you know, I'm not drunk, I'm not high, I'm not crazy, I don't taste pennies, this is a real experience. Like, I don't know how you can turn your life around and go back to your normal life and not follow through on that moment. And so, like, there's that part of me that was like, you know, Bigfoot's kind of like from my childhood. I don't know if you were in search of.
Oh, absolutely. Of course, Leonard Nimoy. Much better than Mitch Pileggi doing it on, no offense to your network.
No. I didn't even know they did it, to be honest.
There you go. But no, Nimoy, back in the 70s, that was a great show.
No, I remember those Bigfoot. Every now and then they'd pull Bigfoot out. Like, Bigfoot was sort of their go-to. Like, you can see them behind the scenes. Like, I don't know, man. The ghost sequence doesn't seem to be working. They're like, let's put some Bigfoot shit up. That Bigfoot shit sells every time.
And the $6 million man too.
Oh yeah, I went as him for Halloween one year. I made the most elaborate bionic Bigfoot costume you can imagine. I had a fake boulder. I had these things. I was like 6 feet, you know, 6 inches taller than I normally am. I had speakers built into the palms of my hands that I could click like Spider-Man's web.
Wow.
That would do the effects from the sound effects from the show. It was crazy. So yeah. My love affair with Bigfoot knows no bounds. And so for me, it was just a chance to do something like that. Unfortunately, we didn't have the budget to do anything too nutty. Otherwise,
sure.
You better believe you would have seen me running around in a Bigfoot costume.
Dust it off. It's time.
Yeah, I wish I still had mine. I would have volunteered for that. That's probably the only way you'll ever see me in any real detail on screen.
Oh, no Hitchcock cameos for you?
I mean, I've cameoed. I challenge people to find me. I'm in the pilot, and I'm in, what episode is it? I'm in the season finale.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Jamie and I both. We're both in the pilot. We're both in the season finale, but, like, I think you'd need TiVo and a microscope and maybe an Enigma machine to figure out which ones we are.
And I wanted to ask about the podcast because I'm glad you guys do these commentaries, and I assume eventually when the DVD set comes out, you guys will just put those on there, and that'll be the commentaries. But I'm glad to see that Colin took such an active role in doing the podcasts as well.
Well, again, he's a go-to guy, man. He loves this thing. Like, you know, he was one of the first people to line up when we talked about doing webisodes. And you got to remember, like, with the lead of a series, especially a series like this, it's very much a point of view series.
Certainly.
Colin's in almost every scene, which means he's always, like, first guy in the morning at work, last guy to go home. He's in every scene, so he's just working his tail off, and he's still the guy to kind of, you know, volunteer to go do whatever, you know, cooking show, you know, that they're using to promote. He's just great. I could not ask for a better lead. And something that, you know, you might want to know about, you know, running a series like this, being a showrunner, is that, you know, the personalities of your actors, especially the lead, it affects everything. It affects your crew. If your lead's always angry or whatever, it's like it really affects everybody. So it's like anything else. Everything's kind of top down. And having Colin, you know, so enthusiastic about the series and so willing to work and go the extra mile, you see it affect the show every day. I can't can't brag about the guy enough, obviously.
As the showrunner, can you guys look at, you know, how the season's gone so far, and are you pleased? I mean, is it staying close to the, you know, the vision that you wanted it to be?
Yeah, I think it's really close. I think I might take things a little darker second season. I'm not sure. I mean,
okay.
There's so many surprises with, like, you know, I love going online and seeing what people liked and didn't like about the various episodes that I was a little more unsure of turn out to be the audience's favorite episodes, and episodes that I love sometimes people don't respond to so well. But I mean, overall, obviously, it's our vision, and I think we got a lot more creative control than a lot of people get on shows like this. It's just a learning. It's a learning curve.
Sure.
You know, we're probably an 8-day show at least, but yet we were a 7-day show for a season. It's just that, you know, you have to cut corners in places, and you have to be very creative about that.
Okay.
And so it's definitely the show we wanted. I mean, we're very proud of it. I think, like I said earlier, like, you know, I'd love to see a little more the humor kind of shine a bit more second season. But that's like anything. Anytime you're doing comedy, it's never funny enough. So
sure.
You always want bigger laughs and better effects and, you know, bigger, better, faster, more. I want it all. I want a lot more money to do the show, and even if they gave me a lot more money, I'm still going to want more money. I just want to see cooler effects. And the effects are great, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't matter. You know, I won't be sad, even if they're like Star Wars level, where we've spent like the gross national product of Uganda on our effects, I still want more. And it's just that kind of show. It's just the kind of show where, you know, on any given episode, like I remember I was up there, and I was having kind of a bad week one week, and I was up in Canada, and I go to the set, and in the same day, I'm like watching a guy climb into a spacesuit, and I'm hanging out with a chimpanzee, you know. And so second season, if I can get the chimpanzee in the spacesuit, done. That's a career high that I'll never come down from. Monkey in a spacesuit, it's over for me. That's my Oscar.
Outstanding.
Yeah, I don't need an Emmy. I don't need an Oscar. Give me a monkey in a spacesuit.
And how has the fan reaction online? Because this is something that I think we take for granted now, because it is so much a part of every show. What's it been like having a fan reaction each week?
It's been great. The instant feedback is amazing. It's really informative. I mean, you can make better decisions as a showrunner. You can. I mean, every day I'm going online and kind of reading what people think about the show. And I was just telling someone yesterday that one of the things I love about the internet is you can find the site where people love the show. Then you can find the site where people hate the show. And what you look for is what are the things that they both like and that they both hate? Because if you got people who love the show, people hate the show, complaining about the same thing, that's something you should probably fix. Not that we're ever going to let, you know, the masses steer us creatively.
Sure.
Or I should say control us creatively. You certainly do take input. I mean, you're kind of stupid if you don't.
Okay.
I mean, that's who you're making the show for. You're making the show for an audience. We'll always trust our own creative vision. We'll always fight for what we believe in. But it's great to have that feedback. It gives you a biorhythm for the series. You know?
Are you gonna make any convention appearances?
Oh yeah, I'll do any convention you want. I love cons.
Cool. Were you in San Diego? Did I miss you in San Diego?
Yeah, we were in San Diego. I was kind of laying low at San Diego.
Okay.
We just kind of like, I was still shell shocked by the 3.2.
Well, yeah, it was that week. Right, it was that week.
Yeah, that Tuesday. And one of my favorite things I did in San Diego was I went to the sci-fi booth where they had Eureka Girls, and, you know, chatting with the Eureka Girls about the show and asking them, well, what's it about, you know, and hearing other people pitch me my show was just a great experience.
That's cool.
But yeah, I mean, the thing with me in San Diego is, like, I go down there to geek out. I go down there to
oh, you bet.
You know, look for comic concepts and buy stuff and, you know, maybe hunt Joss Whedon down and have a lightsaber battle with him.
Well, and it'll be nice now that the first season, when it wraps up, and, you know, people will really have questions for you, and obviously there'll be anticipation, I think, for the hopeful second season. Will you not know until, you know, a month or so after the last show, or do you have any inkling of when you might know if a second season will be greenlit?
We've got an inkling. I think, you know, there's some debate right now as to how many episodes and what the budget would be and everything, but
okay.
I think our numbers have held, and you know, knock wood, I think, you know, here we come.
That's great.
It's just a matter of figuring out all the details because, you know, right now we're a 13-episode show per season, and I certainly wouldn't mind keeping it at 13. There's been talk of more episodes this season. And I, you know, I'm starting to embrace that. I mean, I've always been a proponent of the 13-episode structure for going to DVD and for doing just great shows, and you know, 13 is such a manageable number creatively.
Sure.
But, you know, I love the show, so, you know, if they want me to make more of them, who am I to complain?
Well, and I love the way that Sci-Fi staggers these shows as well, because it is smart that they put on a show like yours in the summer when, you know, everyone else is in reruns, and that's a great opportunity to grow a show, much like they did with Galactica, and they did the same thing with Farscape and Stargate and all of these shows.
I think the key these days is finding an audience. There's so much material out there. There's so many shows to watch, and there's so many channels. And, you know, reality programming, and, you know, people only have so many hours in the day that they're willing to devote to tube watching. It's probably more hours than they should be devoting. not that I'm complaining, but I think Sci-Fi has been really savvy about it, and I hope they continue to be savvy about it. I think if you look at their numbers now, especially Tuesday nights, you know, like, they've really got a nice stranglehold on Tuesday nights. With regard to cable shows and cable stations. And I think they can do it with every night. I think it's really just a matter of choosing the right material and the right shows, and certainly having faith in, you know, and they do. They have a great amount of faith in their creators. It's been a great experience seeing them trust us to create the show we want to create. And you know, some of that's rolling the dice because, you know, I could be crazy. it's seriously, like, you don't know how crazy a showrunner is or how nutty a creator is. I mean, even if you like what he's writing, you know, when all the pieces come together, you can end up going, whoa, what were we thinking?
Yeah, it could be Sam Peckinpah, I understand.
Yeah, you just never know. And before you know it, you've invested a lot of time and money into this show that just could be brilliant, but just doesn't grab hold, doesn't have that sticky quality. But I think as long as they keep doing what they're doing, which is just find people who are passionate about what they want to make, and supporting them in the process of making that, and just do that, do one, even if they just got one for every night of the week. You know, I'm sure that's not the way you do television. I'm sure it's like somewhere someone's going, you don't need a show for Wednesday. What are you talking about? But I definitely think, like, if you look at Galactica and Eureka, and it's, they just need to have a few more of those, and they'll have themselves a pretty nice lineup, I think. And it's science fiction. I mean, it's a great genre. That there's not a ton of it on TV. I mean, obviously the networks tried in a big way this last season, but you know, they've got an audience for it.
Yes.
And they don't need to. Their shows don't need to be, you know, $5 million an episode or whatever. It's not as risky. And certainly if you do these summer launches, like you were saying.
And they're a destination channel. People know what they're getting when they go to the Sci-Fi channel.
Yeah, and hopefully, I mean, that being said, hopefully we're bringing in people who don't normally go to the Sci-Fi channel.
Sure.
Which I do think is part of their business strategy now, is to have more shows like Eureka that are more Earth-based science fiction. And, you know, they've kind of got that market cornered on Stargate, Galactica, and things
sure.
like that. Start bringing sci-fi to people who don't think they like sci-fi. You might even ask me. One of the best things I hear with regards to my show is when someone starts by describing it as, you know, I don't normally like science fiction, but
yes,
I love that. I mean, you know, I certainly want to attract the sci-fi fans, and I'm going to work really hard second season to make sure that every show will appease the most die-hard science fiction fan if possible. But I love that we're attracting people who don't think they like sci-fi or don't normally watch it. That's a tough thing to do.
That's cool. And I was wondering, with that in mind, if there was any thought or plan to cross-promote the show on a sister channel like USA.
You know, I haven't had specific discussions about it. I think it's always in the air. You know, it's what, there's USA, there's Sci-Fi, and NBC are all owned by the same parent company.
Yeah.
I know with Galactica, they did some cross-promotion by showing Galactica on NBC.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly would love to see that done with Eureka.
Sure.
You know, I kind of see us as sort of the desperate housewives for the sci-fi channel. I'd like to see if we can be a little of that in, out there in the big bad world. So, you know, I certainly welcome it. We, like I said, we haven't had specific discussions, but I've heard rumblings of just in terms of strategy. But again, nothing specific.
Well, for people who haven't, you know, who might be catching up and trying to catch the last few episodes, then it's on Tuesday nights on Sci-Fi Channel, 9 p.m. Eastern.
Yep.
And obviously, all the episodes are also available on iTunes as well.
And yeah, I'm not sure. I think there are a couple that aren't up yet.
You know, it's funny. I checked today. It looked like all nine are up there.
Oh, good.
Because, yeah, I went to, that's one of the reasons why I was hoping to watch even more and only saw a couple up there yesterday, but it looks like iTunes 7 has kind of corrected itself.
Oh, that's great. And that may have been on our end. It may have been something like we sent out masters and the masters could have had a glitch in them or whatever, but, like, that's great to hear that they're all up there now.
That's cool. And again, also check out the podcasts as well, which are available at sci-fi.com. And the webisodes are at sci-fi.com as well.
Yeah, and I'm always on there. I'm always reading the message board stuff. As soon as I figure out how to respond to some of them, I will. I'm not the most tech savvy human being on the planet, but I'm learning.
Well, you're a fun storyteller, Andrew, and I really do enjoy Eureka. I think Savage Brothers is very funny, and Exile, and I'm really looking forward to Enigma Cypher as well. So
thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
It's, continued success, and, you know, hey, I hope at the end of the season, maybe I'll get one of you guys to come back on, and we'll review the whole season.
I'd love to, man. We'll grab Jamie, we'll grab Colin next time. And
that'd be great.
We'll make a party of it.
That'd be excellent.
All right, thanks a lot, and I really appreciate this.
That's writer Andrew Cosby. Make sure you check out Eureka on the Sci-Fi Channel, Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Or you can download the episodes right from the beginning at iTunes. And check out the webisode story at sci-fi.com. Also, there's Andrew's books from Boom Studios, Exile, The Savage Brothers, and coming soon, The Enigma Cypher. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Keep coming back to wordballoon.com for updates on upcoming episodes. Lots of great guests are on the way. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2006.